Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White, joined today by Dustin Pendle and Bob Larson. Good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Happy to have you guys with us and looking forward to some of our discussions. We've had some great listener questions, and it's getting to be that time of year, even though it does not look like it. If you look out the window, we are getting close to spring and breeding season. So we've got a couple really good questions on bulls, and we're going to talk through some bull issues today, both with managing those bulls on the operation and a little bit about selection and which bulls we want to select. We're also, as it's again that time of year and we're coming up to calving, we know that colostrum or first milk is very important to those calves. So we will discuss some of the key things to do on your operation to make sure that part of their life goes well. And Dustin's going to give us an update on some of the international trade and the implications for you. Before we get into that, guys, over the recently I had an experience that many people have. You go out, you're checking the cows, you're looking to see, and lo and behold, of course, on a day when you don't have a ton of time, there's one with a prolapse, which is not the fun thing you want to find on a nice cold winter morning.
No, it is not.
you look and you go, that part that's on the outside should be on the inside. So worked through that with my son who was with me and said, we both decided that part should be on the inside. Yeah. And I think, Bob, it was a vaginal cervical prolapse. And I think probably, and others may encounter this too, my guess is moldy hay probably caused her to strain a little bit and go forward. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, that would be pretty high on the list of things that can do that. And the part about moldy hay is there's, you know, mold is actually a pretty kind of bad chemical producer, and it can produce several chemicals, and one of them kind of mimics estrogen. And so those cows that if they eat something that's got some extra estrogen being produced in the mold, and there's some plants as well that are high in estrogen. Yeah, that is a common reason why you'll see that prolapse. The other place you'll see it is just late in pregnancy, very late in pregnancy, the cow naturally makes a lot more estrogen. And that's why a lot of times you'll see that problem in a late pregnancy cow. And then if you put them both together, a cow that's in late pregnancy, and then she's getting some extra estrogen compounds in her feed, you can really run into problems.
Yep, absolutely. And certainly a fixable issue, but not something that you look forward to encounter.
Yeah, yeah. So, not what you wanted to have happen today.
No, absolutely not. So, and I do think, and I bring that up because if it's cold weather, or we've gone through some cold snaps, gone through some other stuff, I think this time of year, you want to address those things relatively quickly because my simplistic biology understanding, stuff that's supposed to be on the inside is made to be on the inside. If it's outside and it's 10 degrees, it does not fare well.
No,
so
it does not.
You want to put it back in the right spot. So let's dive into some of our questions. And I do appreciate you sending us questions. If you ever have questions or things you'd like us to talk about, you can always send us an email at bci@ksu.edu. And we've got a couple questions from different areas of the country today. And the first one, and I think this is a great question, Bob. A producer has bought a couple registered Angus cows from a purebred operation and has decided that he wants to go back to that operation and get a bull. If they don't have any parentage in common, is it okay to breed those together even though they came from the same operation?
Well, there's actually more to this question than you might first think. And that, you know, first of all, so in general, the easy answer is yes. In that what we're concerned about is if you mate animals that are too related to them, you can run into some genetic defects that wouldn't typically show up unless you mate related animals to each other. And also some performance decline, you know, even if you don't see birth defects, they don't have some of the same performance as when you mate bulls and cows that are unrelated to each other. So that's the first. And so if they've checked the pedigrees and they don't have common ancestors, at least as far back as the pedigree, you're probably not going to run into those birth defect type problems. But then another question is, well, what kind of an operation is this? And a little bit more information from the producer in that if this is a purebred operation, then of course we always breed the same breed cow to the same breed bull. But if this is a commercial operation, I think people should consider trying to figure out how to use heterosis or crossbreeding, because there are some real benefits to the fertility of the cows that are crossbred cows versus the fertility of cows that are straightbred cows, even the vigor and health of those calves at birth and through weaning is higher for the calves that are crossbred or if the calves from crossbred cows. And so there's some real benefits to, and kind of back to my earlier statement, it's breeding parents, bull and a cow, that are unrelated by a long ways. In other words, you would have to go back many different breeds, you know, so that they are unrelated to each other. And there seem, you get a kind of a bang for your buck by breeding unrelated parents.
And Dustin, that has some economic ramifications as well, right? When we talk about differences in weaning weights, differences in how those calves grow, growth rates.
Yeah, that absolutely. And so I believe there was somewhat research done that maybe in Nebraska that looked at some of this and talks about weaning weights, higher weaning weights. And
that work out of Nebraska was really pretty good. They looked at the kind of the value of the crossbred cow as separate from the value of that crossbred calf.
Right. And they found a whole lot of different characteristics as a result that were improved, which all have an economic value from calving rates to survival to weaning, birth weights, et cetera, which again all have an economic value.
Yeah. So, and the trade-off there is being sure that you have a crossbreeding system that you can maintain, because if you save heifers and then you want to keep them in the herd, and then I don't want to change my bull every couple of years. So this is a great one. That's an example to work out on a program, work out and make sure that you have a plan for how you're going to handle this. I also think as you look at putting that crossbreeding together, what the market wants or how the market wants that calf to, and sometimes it's just how they want the calf to look that makes a difference, and that plays into your decisions. So being sure that you have a good plan for breeding is important. I also wanted to talk, and Bob, I'll throw a question at you relative to colostrum, and I may just start with the definition. So colostrum, that first milk that calf gets, that has a lot of his immunity, because calves, their immune system's not fully developed at birth. They don't start generating immunity right away. So his mother gives him immunity through that first milk. And that really sets him up the first several months of his life to be able to battle some of the pathogens. So we often talk about first milk, colostrum, absolutely critical. And I want to start out with a question before we start modifying it. How soon does that calf absorb that colostrum, or when should he get colostrum within his life?
Yeah. So, and cattle are, this is true for all species, but more important for some species than others. And for cattle, that first milk is really important. They just don't have much immune protection that they got during the pregnancy. And so almost all protection they're going to have as a young calf is what they're going to absorb from that colostrum. And a couple of things we know is that window of opportunity, because those antibodies, those proteins that provide protection, they're large. And they're only actually able to be absorbed through the gut wall during that first day of life. And what we say is even the first 12 hours is better than the second 12 hours of that first day of life. So the answer to the question of is basically as soon as possible. I would like that calf to get up and suckle as soon after birth as is feasible. So you're talking minutes, not hours. And I want him to get up and start suckling, and then to be vigorous enough where he's going to suckle several times in that first 12 hours. That's the calf that I think is going to get the best protection from that first mother's milk.
So how much colostrum should they get in that first 12 hours or first 24 hours?
And a lot of, when we talk about colostrum management, we've learned a lot from our dairy brothers, because the humans are going to hand feed colostrum to those calves. And so, you know, they, and Holstein calves are a little more consistent in their weight and stuff. So they're going to get, you know, several liters into those calves again in that first 24 hours. So they're going to come back several times with a tube feeder or bottle feeder and get those calves colostrum. With beef cattle, we're really counting on the cow to do that for us. So the answer really is, well, as much as the cow is going to give. I would like to handle, you know, I'd like them to get, you know, like we talk about in dairy calves, you know, half gallon here and half gallon there, so that they really build up a pretty good immunity pretty quickly. In a beef operation, it's going to be however much their mother has. That's a really good point is, so I need that mother to bond with her calf. I need her to have made some good quality colostrum and for that calf to be vigorous enough to get up and really suckle. And if that all happens, I've done all I can do to get a good dose of colostrum into that calf.
So it's really about managing, and I want to follow up on something that you mentioned there. It's about managing that cow. And so Dustin asked, how much should I give? But there's also a quality and quantity issue when we think about colostrum and colostrum production. And both are impacted by the nutritional status of that cow.
Yeah. And again, so much of what we know, we talk about from dairy cows. And they tend to have because they have so much more milk, it tends to be a little bit more dilute. So a smaller volume from a beef cow is probably providing as much antibody protection as a larger volume from a dairy cow. But it's really about the health and vigor of that cow. So if she's in good body condition, she's been on a good plane of nutrition, she's got the protein, energy, minerals, stuff that she needs, she'll concentrate that antibody into that first milk. And again, they do their job pretty well.
Those antibodies are proteins, and she's making them specifically for the calf. She can't make proteins from nothing. So if she's not in great shape, she's going to make fewer proteins to put into her colostrum.
Yeah, I totally believe that. I think she just needs to be a good, healthy, good body condition score cow to really maximize that colostrum quality and quantity.
She also needs to have some exposure to the previous pathogens you're concerned about, so she knows what kind of antibodies to make.
Yeah. And a lot of times, again, it kind of fits into our overarching herd health plan. You know, so we have a vaccination protocol for our cows to protect them against the diseases that can cause abortion or respiratory disease in their herd. And by having those cows well vaccinated to protect them, you're also then having that cow pass that protection onto her calf as well.
So having well vaccinated cows are in good shape. Anything else that I should be thinking about relative to managing colostrum?
Yeah, there are a couple of important things. One is basically, and I'll just say what I really want to happen is for that calf to be rigorous shortly after birth so that he did not experience a difficult birth. So with calves born to heifers, which is probably my biggest problem, I want to develop those heifers well and to select bulls to breed to those heifers that kind of control and minimize the risk of those really large calves that are going to cause some calving difficulty. So I want to manage so that we have a small amount of calving difficulty, so those calves are likely to get up and be rigorous and ready to suckle. I like them born in a clean environment. Again, just nothing that would cause that calf to just want to huddle down and not be vigorous. So a good environment. Born to a mother that's in good body condition, that's been on a good diet, and especially with calves born from heifers, that the sire was selected to really kind of control the amount of risk for calving difficulties. And then if you did run into calving difficulties, so you had to go out or you had to have the veterinarian out to help, I know that calf probably isn't going to be as vigorous as what I wanted. I said, I want that calf to just jump up and be ready to suckle. Well, if I had to pull the calf or have a C-section or anything like that, that's not going to happen. So, and that's the case where you're going to, you know, get the cow into a head catch and milk her out and give her colostrum to the calf. The human does that for him. Or you can use a commercial supplement in those cases if you have trouble getting that colostrum from the cow, because sometimes she's not a milk cow and she doesn't really agree to partner with you on that. And so,
that is the nicest way. She doesn't agree to partner with you on that. Yeah, anybody that's tried to milk a beef cow knows that that's a drastic understatement.
Yes, it is. So she's trying to kick you really vigorously. Yeah. And so you may choose to not participate in that activity yourself. And then a powdered supplement or something would be a great alternative. Yeah. So again, when we talk about dairy calves, the humans manage that system. With beef cows, I want the cow to manage it unless I have to help, and then I'll help.
Now, wait. I do want to follow up. So powdered supplement, I can get colostrum from my local dairy, or I can get a powdered supplement, or I can go without. What would you recommend? So I've got a cow. I can't milk her. She doesn't have colostrum, maybe she didn't make it.
Yeah, and this is different. Veterinarians are going to have different preferences. I guess my preference is towards the powdered replacement. I don't think it's as good as Mother Nature, as good as the cow. And so you say, well, why don't you go to a dairy? Well, there are some germs that can pass through the colostrum, through the milk. And so I kind of want to keep my herd a little bit more closed than that. So I am a veterinarian that doesn't really like to bring colostrum in from another herd. But everything's a trade-off. I think real cow colostrum probably is better than the powdered colostrum, but with the powdered colostrum, I'm more confident that I'm not going to bring in any germs to my herd. So I'm pretty comfortable with the commercial powdered products that are available in that type of a situation.
Yep, absolutely. And I would agree with you. I think they will provide you some benefit, don't provide you as much as certainly going to the cow. And even his own dam is going to have better than the colostrum. So even though it's a pain, sometimes you can milk from his mother. That's better than going to the powdered. So don't just jump to that. So absolutely. I think a lot of good management tips there as far as colostrum. It's critical. It sets him up the first several months of their life. And that leads us to our Cattle Chat checklist for today, which is on managing colostrum in beef cows.
Number 5, have a clean calving environment.
Number 4, maintain the appropriate cow vaccination strategy.
Number 3, if you have an assisted birth, intervene with colostrum.
Number 2, limit calving difficulties in the heifers.
And number 1, make sure those cows calve in good body condition.
And that's our BCI Cattle Chat checklist for this week. Dustin, I know you enjoyed our colostrum talk, but let's shift gears a little bit and shift from milk and talk international trade.
How did you make that transition?
Yeah, there it is. I think you're often, aren't you often talking about something like milk and you're like, hey, let's think international trade.
It's exactly where I would go. I mean, it's pretty linear.
Pretty linear
thought process. So yeah, earlier this month, there was some news from an international trade standpoint. Taiwan specifically, they made some market access changes for the U.S. beef and actually pork as well. But specifically for beef, they eliminated that rule that was cattle had to be, less than 30 months of age. So that has been eliminated. So now Taiwan will accept cattle from all ages here in the U.S. And it's only noteworthy is because we've talked about trade before in the past and the value that trade adds to, let's say, an animal, a carcass, the value of an animal, which I want to say we've seen numbers, $300 to $350?
Of the value of export if you spread that out over all the calves in the country or all the cattle.
Yeah, I think that the export value per head of a slaughtered cow, fat cattle. And so that's why trade is important. It does increase the demand for either high value products or products that we don't consume here in the
U.S. Yeah, and one of the things
ultimately
I was just going to say, I can remember when we had the BSE cow and all of a sudden trade was limited. That had
zero.
tremendous impact on the value of cattle. And our domestic consumption was fine. It was the, and it became really clear that, yeah, we are really benefiting from being able to export cattle and cuts to other parts of the world. So we I think if we didn't understand the value at that time, we understand it now.
And I don't think if I'm an individual producer, I'm not going to see when I sell my calves, it's not going to be like, oh, you get this much for international trade. It's prices rise for cattle. And so everybody might benefit from it. But just a quick, in Taiwan, just in 2020, and this is only through November's data. USDA hasn't put out December's data, but our largest export market was Japan, or at least so far in 2020. And they 20%, 29% of our exports went to Japan in terms of volume, followed by Canada and Mexico at 10% each. Hong Kong and Taiwan were both at 7%. So you can see, well, I guess South Korea had 23% of export market. So again, that Asian market is very valuable to the U.S. beef industry.
Yeah. That seems like good news. If that you said previously it was 7%, and that was with restrictions. So as these restrictions are kind of rolled back, we'd like to see that number really increase.
And actually through November of 20, we were 3% ahead of 2019's export numbers. So we were on pace to set a record for beef exports, U.S. beef exports to Taiwan. So good news there, I guess.
I think great news. And really, I think we all feel that in a positive way. And probably personally, a lot of us didn't do a lot of work to make that happen, but it takes work to make those things happen. There's your trade organizations, there's your professional organizations that are out doing some of that work. So I think participate as an industry participant, we benefit from some of those things. So I feel like there are also some things I want to contribute to as far as making sure that we have the professional organizations that have our best interest at heart. Right. I mean, this didn't happen from, they didn't just say, absolutely, Hey, we're going to send more money your way.
No, absolutely. And so on the pork side, just to note what they did there was they had a limit or a zero tolerance policy for the maximum residue limits for ractopamine residues. Yep. Well, they're easing that. And so again, it's not, I mean, I didn't do anything. You didn't do anything. It is the USMCA.
Yeah,
that's and other organizations that are out there lobbying on our behalf.
Yep. US Meat Export Federation, right?
Yes, USMEF Export Meat Federation and Foreign Ag Service and whatnot.
Yep, lots of folks out there. So I think that's great news, Dustin. And hopefully as we continue to export and grow, that increases demand helps everybody's prices. I want to shift back, and I got another bull listener question here, and I think this is an interesting one, and it's not just about what bulls do I buy. We talked about maybe breeding decisions earlier, but this is really focused on, okay, I'm going to get two new bulls, bring them to my operation. They're going to be out in the same pasture. A little bit concerned about what's the best way to introduce them to that environment. Right. I want to breed them this spring. I'm going to get them now. And I'm modifying the question a little bit just to be more specific for you, Bob. What would your recommendation to me be?
Well, and I think what the listener is obviously saying is I'm worried about these bulls fighting, even, you know, hurting each other, getting into trouble. And I agree. I'm always concerned about that, too, because, you know, if you've ever been around putting bulls together that hadn't been together before, they're going to establish a dominance hierarchy. And sometimes they do that just from kind of threatening postures. And sometimes they actually break into a good fight. And he's saying, well, I don't want that. I just spent quite a bit of money to buy a couple of bulls. I don't want them fighting and hurting each other. The challenge is how to make that less likely. And I wish I knew exactly. I think sometimes some strategies people do is allow them to become visually in sight with each other with a strong fence between them. The problem with that is they can tear down fences and get into trouble, but kind of first visual, and then you put them into a pasture together. And about the only advice I have is, well, make sure the pasture is kind of free of problems where they can, you know, so ditches, things that they can get hurt on, those kinds of things.
What kind of pasture is free of stuff they can get hurt on? Okay, you can have a pasture, but no ditches, no trees, no fences, no, nothing, no posts.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So, but just don't put them in the desert. So don't put them in your worst one. Put them in, of the pastures where you could put them, you know, keep in mind, yeah, there's fewer places for them to get hurt. And then give them space.
Ample space. I think what you're saying is key. Ample space.
If one wants to break off and not participate in this fight, they've got room to leave. Yeah. And so that's a real concern. Well, and then the one other thing I'll throw out is there, and the listener asks about, well, how do I, you know, move them in and out of the pasture and stuff? I would say carefully, because every year we run into people getting hurt by bulls. And you know, a common history is, well, I've had this bull for years and I've never had a problem with him until today when he hurt me. And so I think you just need to treat bulls with the respect they deserve. They're a ton. Their brains are pretty small. Not sure exactly what they're thinking all the time. And again, if they're really interested in fighting with another bull or something like that, the person there is not what they're going to focus on, and you don't want to get caught in there. So,
and don't try to, not a case to try to separate. I mean, nope. You just deal with the aftermath if you have to, but I think putting them together, open spaces where they've got room to go back and forth, minimal things in there that they can get hurt on. I agree with, even though
how much you can do about it.
Right. Not much you can do about a lot of those cases, and make sure that this happens before it's time for breeding season. And I think you want to have, if something does happen, you give time to recover. Most times it's going to go okay, but it doesn't matter. Cattle are very social and their behaviors are all socially oriented, and they're going to have a social hierarchy. That social hierarchy is going to be established, and it doesn't matter whether I'm putting heifers together or I'm putting some new cows into the herd, or even if I take a cow that was in the herd and I removed her for 3 weeks because she was sick and then I put her back in, they will sometimes have to go through that reestablishment process. And it's just part of their social hierarchy. Usually it goes okay. Sometimes with two bulls, it doesn't. But I would put them in together, let them kind of get accustomed to each other. The other part of this question was, as we think of both putting bulls in and bringing them out, the kind of nutritional implications. And we're going to talk about that on a podcast very soon, especially as we start preparing these bulls for the breeding season. Because it's almost time, and I like how they, you know, you think about baseball. You have the hot stove league, and then you say, okay, we're doing the grapefruit league, and we're getting close to spring training here. That's where we are with bulls. So it's time to start thinking about that now. You're thinking about spring training, and here in a couple weeks, we're going to go through our preseason protocol for what we want to do with those bulls. So I'll save that question, and I appreciate you joining us today. And if you have questions, thoughts, anything you'd like us to talk about on a future podcast, you can always send us an email at bci@ksu.edu.